We started away from Billets at 2:30 on the afternoon of October the 12th, having marched about 20 miles and arrived at our new line of trenches, which had been captured from the Germans about a week before. We arrived about 3:30 in the morning. We relieved the guards. Of course, we were very tired. We were able to rest until 11 o'clock. Then bomb throwers were detailed, and at 12 o'clock, a very heavy bombardment commenced. This was one of the heaviest bombardments ever known, hundreds of guns being massed together. The bombardment lasted until 1:55, and as soon as the fire ceased, a party of bomb throwers went forward, bombing the enemy. We were in the support trenches, and the 5th North Staffords occupied the fire trenches ahead of us, a distance of about 100 yards. The 5th North Staffs advanced first across the short distance, intervening between them and the enemy, and we followed up in support. I think at least 30 German machine guns were playing on the open ground, but our men faced the hail of bullets without flinching. Many of them were mown down like rabbits between the support and fire trenches. Orders came along that reinforcements were wanted for the 5th North Staffs, and men of the two battalions were able to capture the first line fire trench and supports, and also the second line trenches of the enemy. Colonel Ratcliffe was the first to leap out of the support trench, but many of the men who surrounded him were cut down in the first few yards. He bravely went on, however, and safely reached the fire trench and where the 6th North Staffords made their actual charge, with the colonel leading the way. The actual charge and bomb fighting must have lasted for 3/4 of an hour, and the Germans who were not killed or wounded were obliged to fall back. We managed, however, to take a number of prisoners. At about 3 o'clock, there was a lull in the fighting, and then the enemy counterattacked. We repulsed them, and then they shelled our supports who were coming up. Then they had another try with bombs to clear us out at night, and again we repulsed them. During the night, there was a lull in the fighting again, and it continued quiet until 4 o'clock on the Thursday afternoon, and they did not come for us. Between the periods of fighting, excellent work was done in taking the wounded from the trenches and communication trenches. About the action in general, I can say this, every man stood his ground like a true British soldier. There was no grumbling, whatever work had to be done. We were relieved on the Friday morning and got away safely. After a march of 6 miles, we had a breakfast and a rest and then went further afield to our billets. On Saturday, we were inspected by the general, who complimented the battalion and said he was proud of us. The casualties are, of course, heavy, but fully 70% of them were what we will call blighty wounds, arms and legs, and they should recover all right. The Germans must have lost far more heavily than we did. The German trenches we captured are quite 12 feet deep and have a fire shelf from which they fire through loopholes. The dugouts, which are splendidly equipped, are a further 6 feet further lower down. I am told that barrels of beer and hot coffee were found in their dugouts by our men. They had evidently made careful preparations for the winter, for the trenches are splendidly drained. They were the words written by a man called Private Percy Manwaring, who came from Burton-on-Trent. And he was a servant to his commanding officer that he mentioned there, a man called Colonel Ratcliffe, who was a Member of Parliament. And he was describing what happened on the 13th of October 1915, when the Territorials of the 46th North Midland Division attacked the German positions during the Battle of Loos in what was known as the Hohenzollern Redoubt. So welcome to another episode of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And what we're going to do this week is talk to an historian and battlefield guide, Beth Moore. Beth lives in the area where these men came from, in the West Midlands, or the North Midlands as they called it then. And she spent several years researching what happened on that one fateful day when so many of the men that live in her neighbourhood were cut down by those German Maxim machine guns that Manwaring was talking about. So let's go over now and talk to Beth and find out what happened on that awful day 109 years ago now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, we're going to talk about then the Hohenzollern Redoubt. I've been there loads of times, but yeah, I still haven't got my head around it.
It is baffling, isn't it?
Like, it is. Trying to understand it, you know, with what's there today. And also the fact that it went on for so long. You know,
yeah.
I mean, where I'm sitting here in Northampton, our lads arrived here, you know, the Northampton lads, the 7th Battalion, they arrived at the Hohenzollern Redoubt on the second day. And it was their first day in action, and they had hundreds cut down that day, and then it
Yeah.
went on and on, didn't it? And then my great uncle in March of 1916, he was there with the six buffs, and it was just the East Kent Regiment, and it was just like in the same trench fighting each other, siege warfare, wasn't it? And
Yeah,
it.
that's it's the one that the one particular position was I love the names of like Big Willie and Little Willie.
Oh, no.
But it's Big Willie that if I remember correctly, the on the 8th of October that the Scottish division had got pushed, they'd got pushed back to, and that's where some of the attack on the 13th started.
Yeah.
But the Germans had been at the top end and were firing down
In the same trench. Yeah. Yeah. Well,
onto the buffs.
before we do
Cool.
that, we've got to do some proper introductions. So first of all, welcome to the podcast, Beth. It's great to get you on at long last. We've been talking about this for some time. But first of all, tell us, where did you get the bug from to be interested in the Great War? It's unusual to have someone from your generation doing this.
It is, and to be honest, I started off. I mean, at school, I always loved history. Like right from a very young age, it was always one of my favorite things. Like one of my most vivid memories of school is going to near where I live. There's a town called West Bromwich, and they've got an old Tudor house there called the Oak House. And I remember going on that day and being like, they dressed us up in costumes, and like it was just amazing. By the time I'd got to about 14, I'd read every single book in the library in the
Really?
school, and I was bored of books. And my dad handed me the book of Band of Brothers, and he said, "Give that a go, see what you think."
So this is the Stephen Ambrose book, the
Yes,
Band of Brothers. Yeah.
yeah, and. When I read it, I loved it. I found it. I think the Ambrose books are a good way to get yourself introduced to a topic, much like any book. You've got books that are good introductions, and then you
Yeah.
go on from there.
Yeah, three different levels, I think Paul Reed described
Yeah,
things. Yeah.
absolutely. So I read it when I was 14, and I loved it. And then we watched the TV series, and I loved that as well. And we'd always been to Normandy on family holidays, but we'd stayed higher up, more to, in a place called Ourgat, more towards Deauville.
Yeah.
We'd always gone there on our holiday, so then we crossed over the river and started staying on the beaches side and doing that. And so, because I'm one of three girls, I'm the oldest of three girls, and I think my dad made me a bit of a surrogate boy, in a way. like, oh, someone who's interested, I can then do this with them.
Share it with you, yeah.
And I love that because, it is something that me and my dad share. But when we were on that one of those trips, I remember. The school had just come out and said, "Oh, we've got a battlefield, First World War battlefields trip." And I was like, "Mom, Dad, I want to go." And they said, "Yeah, of course. Let's get you on the trip." And because, like any good nerd does, I did pre-reading for the trip. I wasn't just going to go and know
No,
nothing.
no.
I needed to pre-read, and I was that kid. And anyone who's a teacher, battlefield guide, anyone who's worked with kids knows that you have a shadow on a tour.
Yeah.
In the classroom,
That
that was me.
was
That
you.
was me, and I made a bit of an impression. But because I'd done the pre-reading, I fell in love with the subject
Yeah.
then. And I am one of the First World War historians who feel that you can't, in my mind, you can't understand the Second World War without having a basis of the knowledge of the First World War. You just can't.
No.
Then you could go back further, and you could go, well, what about the
Well, the two are
Franco-Prussian?
connected, aren't they? The Second World War happened because the First World War, the way it finished,
Yeah,
eventually.
yeah.
Yeah.
I went through a phase of calling the Second World War First World War 2.0,
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
because it
Yeah.
almost feels like a bit of an extension.
Yeah.
But I went on that trip and I loved it, and I ended up doing it at History and War Studies at uni. And I always wanted to do something that revolved around my degree and my love of, the subject. Most of my mates from uni have gone on and they do graduate jobs, and they've got wonderful high flying jobs, and they're absolutely fantastic in what they do. But I was like, I've grew up in a family where we didn't do Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. I grew up in a family of shift workers who worked odd hours or different jobs, and I kind of wanted that for myself. And it eventually led to me working for Anglia Tours and becoming a
Yeah.
battlefield guide, and I've done that for 8 years in March.
That's fantastic, isn't it? Obviously, we've met, that's how we met, wasn't it, out on the battlefields.
Yes,
We
it was,
were
yeah.
following each other around one day, as we—that's how battlefield guides meet, isn't it? Out there.
You see someone in the distance, you go, I vaguely know who they are. I
Yeah.
must go
And then I remember seeing you at the Menin Gate later that night. There was a big dog by the side of you that I don't know where he'd come from.
Oh, I think it was one of the Last Post Association people. I think it was his dog that they. So his dog does occasionally appear, but not
Yeah.
very often because he is a monster. He is
It was
horse-like.
massive, wouldn't it? I've not seen him before. So what got, so we're going to talk about the 46th North Midland Division,
Yes.
in particular. And what took your interest in that? Is it because it's local to you?
In essence, yes. So I knew about the story of Goncourt. I think anyone who studied the 1st of July knows about Goncourt, but what really sort of kicked it off was during COVID. That wonderful time, 2020, when I wasn't doing anything, I ended up having to get a job to sort of because I couldn't just sit in the house, so I ended up getting like a part-time temporary job. But I decided to do a bit of a project, and I'm still working on this project 4 years later, and it's a list of men from the area where I live, because it's I live in the West Midlands conurbation, so all these old historic villages and towns have merged together since that time. But I took an area and I was looking how many, basically I wanted to see how many men died from the area. Out in my boundaries that I've set upon, which it includes the area of Rowley Regis, Blackheath and Old Hill. I've got 411 of them,
Blimey.
which I think is for an area that was very heavy in manufacturing and industry during the First World War and had lots of protected occupations, reserved occupations. I think that number's quite high. And I was like, well, there must be a reason. And of course, I mean, most of them are post conscription. Like more than half of them die 1917 onwards. But there is a big chunk where I had two dates that overlapped.
That
The
kept
first,
cropping up.
they kept cropping up, the 13th of October 1915 and the 1st of July 1916. I was like, these two dates keep cropping up.
But the strange thing is about that, as you say, so many people know about Common Core, 1st of July 46, and the London Division, but they don't realise, and this is probably what prompted you, they don't realise what had happened in the previous year. And
Exactly.
who were they? Were they POWs or territorials? What's
There were territorials.
So weekend soldiers, Saturday soldiers,
And actually, from the research I've done, quite a few of them were ex-soldiers as well. Anyway, so lots of them had already done their 12-year stint and then had moved into the territorials, which obviously had, been the big changes with the Haldane reforms in 1908. They've made some big changes to those structures. But they were local men. They are all men from the North Midland area. So they are Staffordshire.
And that keeps cropping up, doesn't it? Staffordshires.
Yes. So we've got Staffordshire, we've got Lincolnshire, Leicestershire, and Nottinghamshire, Derbyshire as well. Where I live is basically on the border of what was the Staffordshire Regiment, Worcestershire Regiment, and Warwickshire Regiment. So whilst I do have a lot in the 46th Division, I do have a lot in like the Worcesters as well. So they crop up in the 48th and so on. But they were just a local bunch, and the dates and the names just kept cropping up. So I dove into it a little bit more and just started researching it and fell into a complete rabbit hole because I think they're a fascinating bunch.
You'll never finish, you realize that. Your project will never ever be finished.
Never finish. It'll never finish. I want to try and visit as many of these 400 men as I can. I do have people who've visited some for me. Like I haven't got to Gallipoli yet, so someone's been to Gallipoli and taken photographs of headstones for me. So off the 411, I'm up to 218.
Not bad.
Now there are some that will be difficult, like the seven that are in Iraq. They will be difficult.
However, we can sort that because I'm a volunteer for the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, and I hope a couple of years ago we managed to get a photo of a headstone in Iraq for someone through the
So
local
because
contractors.
I found online the memorial, like the panels of the memorial, but I just thought the ones here in the cemetery, I thought, well, their headstones will just be destroyed, won't they?
No, but they were destroyed, but it's all been rebuilt again. So the headstones are back, and the commission used local Iraqi contractors to rebuild the cemeteries that are there. And it's Iraqi contractors that work for the commission looking after them. So if you send me the details, I'm sure we'll be able to get
Absolutely.
them.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I would love those headstones because, particularly those places, like when on earth would anyone who was a miner from this area or a laborer, when on earth would their family, no one would ever get to see them in
No,
a rat.
that's right. That's right. If you can get a photo of them, then you know they go. It'll be good for your project, and it also knows that someone visited their grave.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's how it sort of started, and then I fell into the 46th Division, and they are such an I think an interesting bunch because of how they get to Hohenzollern Redoubt and how they get to Gommecourt as
So
well.
where had they? Where did they arrive? When did they arrive? Sorry, on the Western Front
So
early on.
they are actually the first territorial division to arrive as a full unit. Right at the beginning of March 1915, they had been observed by the king in Chelmsford,
That's
Saffron,
where they
whatever
were
it
doing
was.
their training down in Essex.
Yeah, so they were doing their training down there before they went off to the Western Front, and the king came to visit them because their divisional commander, who has the most fantastic name in the world, he is Major General Edward James Montague Stuart Wortley. And yes, that is a triple-barreled surname.
No, he didn't come out the mines then, did
No, he did not come out of the mines. He was an army man. He'd served everywhere. You know, he'd been in Afghanistan, the Sudan. He'd been on the relief of Khartoum. He had like extensive knowledge, and he was always considered like a really good trainer of men, and was very well respected. He'd only been given command of the division in June of 1914, so he wanted to bring them up to his standard, but he was a friend of the king's as well. There's 137th Brigade, which is the Staffordshire Brigade, 138th, which is Lincoln's and Leicester's, and then 139th, which is Notts and Derby
We've got the
Brigade.
three brigades, and
Yeah.
would that be about 15,000 men then, approximately?
Well, so no, the territorial divisions always ran, and it is noted in the 46th Division papers that they run less than a standard divisional rate. So, you know, on a good day, a good day, you'd say that a division had somewhere maybe up to about 18,000, maybe 20. Depends on how you're looking, but they are lower. So, for example, even if you look at their individual battalion strength, it's usually somewhere around about 1,000. The territorial battalions are 800, so they are even smaller right at the
Smaller,
beginning.
yeah.
So
And that's quite
they're
traditional.
already, yeah. And this is important, particularly for Hohenzollern and then Gommecourt, which is something I'm very passionate about. They're already down on numbers, the new army and the regular divisions have, but then after Hohenzollern, their casualties don't get replaced in the same amount. So they are working on like a 65%. I've worked it out like to the percentage. They work on like 68% strength of what a regular or new army division has, 68%, which is mad. But they are the first full unit to arrive. One thing that is very important for them, what happens to them later, is that when they are visited by the king, it says in the war diary that they're visited by the king in February 1915, and that the king asks the divisional commander for regular reports on the progress of the division. So they had known each other. They sort of moved in the same circles. There are family connections as well, like quite loosely, but there are connections between the king and Montague Stuart Wortley. And he'd asked for letters to be sent to him about the division progress.
So I could
So
keep an eye on them.
yeah, so Montague Stuart Wortley is writing to the king, and it says in his papers and the research that's been done into this, I'd love to get into those papers somewhere. There must be somewhere, that he was writing to the king, and that's important for a fallout that happens. Well, it's not responsible, but it's certainly a part of the fallout that happens that Stuart Wortley has with his corps commander and army commander at Hohenzollern Redoubt, who are Haking and Haig.
Yes, so going up the line.
Yeah. So when this division arrived in France, like they did the standard training, the battalions get taken out and circulated into quiet sectors so that they can experience trench life. And they were doing this for the best part of 6 months. They are in support of the 14th Division at the Flamethrower.
So they're at Hook, are they?
They
So
are at Hooghur,
they're at
yeah.
Hook,
They
and that's
start
not
around this, yeah, they
a
start
great
around
way,
this
is it? It's
time.
not a great introduction to the Western Front, is it, to be around
No.
1915?
No, so they, I mean, they do start around Messines, which is considered a quieter
Quiet
area,
area,
but
yeah.
they are in support of 14th Division at Hooghur, and it does say in the notes that actually some elements were sent forward in preparation
Yeah.
for what might happen. They get to the end of September when the Battle of Loos starts. So at the end of September, they're still up in Ypres.
Yeah.
They are situated in Ypres. They're experiencing life in Ypres. They in the salient, they know how to operate in the salient. An order is then given at the end of September to move down to the Loos battlefield.
It's already started at this stage then,
Yeah, it had already started, and 46th Division weren't even in the area. They don't arrive in the Loos battlefields until the first week of October. By the time they've entrained everywhere, moved the whole division, we're looking at the first week of October by the time the 46th Division have got to Loos. Now we know that there's been the attack there on the 25th, which did take the redoubt and did go all the way up to Fosse 8, and to the village. But the Germans had been slowly pushing back.
Yes, through the dump and places like that.
Yeah, around the dump, Fosse 8, the Corons as well. They'd been pushing back.
And the Corons, for people that haven't come across this phrase before, these are the miners' cottages. This is a mining area of northern France, isn't it? And this is where the miners live. They called them the Corons.
Yeah, they're a little bit like, if you look at, sort of terraced housing, Victorian terraced housing, they're a little bit like, they've got that kind of vibe to them.
Yeah.
They're rows and rows and rows of houses where everyone lives in each other's pockets kind of
Yes.
situation. I think they look quite nice, actually, but in the pictures, I think they look quite nice. But
Yeah.
yeah, they're in very cramped conditions. But obviously, they're then being used as, the Germans have
Defensive
obviously
positions. Yeah.
a
And
defensive
what
position.
did the did they when they arrived then at the beginning of October, did the division go straight into the line or did they go to Vermelles and they were in support areas, reserve areas?
So what happened is they don't actually get into the trenches that they are attacking from for the 13th of October until early hours of the morning of the 13th. They're supposed to start the relief of the guards units there that they relieve on the 12th of October. That's supposed to be done by 6:45. The units are not fully in place by 6 o'clock on the morning of the attack.
So they've
So
not
they don't
seen the
have.
battlefield before. They've not done any recce or anything.
No, what they do know is that because they didn't, the troops on the ground hadn't seen the battlefield didn't mean that the divisional officers hadn't. So Montague Stuart Wortley had already in the process. So they entrain and they end up around Bethune, and
Yep.
those battlefields around there. The Montague Stuart Wortley has a meeting with the GSO1 of 9th Scottish Division.
Who'd been there before?
Yeah, we're talking about the attack on the 8th. The Germans launched their counteroffensive at Hohenzollern Redoubt, which hadn't actually existed. I found out, quite to my shame, very recently, had only been created in 1915.
What did it actually look like then? The Hohenzollern Redoubt, and what did it,
So,
what was its appearance?
a redoubt is essentially like a not just a German position, but it is a fortified German position. How it looks is, if you look at a bit of a triangle, you've got Hohenzollern Redoubt is the point of the triangle. You've got then two trenches that go off from either side, which are called very cheekily Big Willy and Little Willy,
And
which
this is
are.
the British using their humour to take the Mickey out the Kaiser, isn't it?
It
Yeah.
is, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they've been called Big Willy and Little Willy.
Yeah.
And you can still go to the Hohenzollern Redoubt today and see it. It is a time where we're using concrete bunkers.
Yeah.
Fortified positions. We're obviously using miles and miles and miles of barbed wire as well.
Yeah.
And using the ground, using the fact that it's a sort of a slightly higher point of ground on what is a very, very, very flat piece
It
of
is,
ground.
isn't it? Yeah. See for miles.
It's so flat. I mean, the first time I went, I couldn't actually believe. I was like, well, I know it's flat, but then you don't actually realize just how flat it is. And I think in points, it's even more impressive to see that than like when you're in Ypres and you're like, oh, this is the high ground, surely not. And then you go to Luce and it's like, where is this high ground? So they're using the Hohenzollern Redoubt, which they've built on top of a little bit of higher ground. Behind that, there's Fosse 8, which is Fosse essentially is just a big pit. This is a mining area. So obviously you have pits because they're digging for coal, which also then is simultaneously important because at the time, coal is the main source of fuel, isn't it? So you want areas that are going to provide you with something as well.
With resources. So
Yeah.
really then the difficulty that they were going to have attacking the Hohenzollern Redoubt, which is like a bulge sticking out then into no man's land, is the Germans can therefore see from their positions in all directions, in three directions, can't they? Can enfilade, they can fire from the side to any attacking troops. And these trenches that they built are very deep, and they've got machine gun positions in them. And they've also got a high position behind called the dump, haven't they? And this is where the spoil is it? Is that what the dump
Yeah,
is? Spoil
it's
from the mines?
the spoil from Fosse 8. Anyone who's been to Luce or has at least seen pictures of Luce know that because it's a mining area, you've got the spoil, which is all topped up onto the side, basically.
Which is
Obviously,
still there, isn't it? Still there.
you've got the very famous like double crater as
Which you can
well,
see. You can see
which
the
you can
old
see for
crap here, can't you?
miles. You can see them for miles. Because that whole plain, the Douai Plain, the whole of it is used for mining. So you can look and you've got slag heap here, slag heap there. They're everywhere. So
So what
it's
they're doing then in the Hohenzollern, they've got to take this because it's they've lost, taken it, lost it, taken it, lost it over the previous couple of weeks or so. And there's been lots and lots of casualties. They've still got to take it. It's still sitting there. And this is the northern part of the Loos battlefield, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Yeah. So it is vitally important to sort of holding on to that middle anchoring bit. It's like middle to north. It's like halfway between across that battlefield, and it's vital to keeping that battlefield held. And
Secure.
every battle is the intention is for every battle that it wins the overall arc. You may have this as your objective and this is your next objective, but obviously the overarching thing is to defeat the Germans, win the war, and everything is up to that higher objective. Yes, you have Loos, but then you have to plan in advance in case those attacks don't go to
So that
plan.
was their objective then, was it?
They hadn't, as I said earlier, hadn't got into the positions until the
No.
morning of. But Montagu Stuart Wortley had meetings with various GSO1s, so the staff officers of 9th Division, basically saying, tell me what you did and tell me what you wish you could have done or should have done. How did you operate? What
How
did
can we
you do?
learn?
How can we learn? And this is something that he's really quite keen on. And he has quite a lot of these meetings. Now, once he's had these meetings, he presents his own version of a plan. So basically, in the days before the attack had taken place, his corps commander, who is a Haking, had basically said to attack in the same way that 9th Division had done.
Okay. Well, that didn't work.
But yes, that didn't work. Well, on the well, how the, so there's two elements to it. How they'd attacked on the 20, like in September, which obviously they have taken the positions, but then obviously they lose them, don't they? So he said, look, the plan worked a couple of weeks ago. That's your plan.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Yeah, so Stuart Wortley had said he'd looked at what had happened then in between period, the October, the first week, and said, well, actually, it didn't work. And we look at the terrain, it's not chalky like the Somme, it's not clay like Ypres, it's different. So you've got to work in a different way that use the topography with the trenches. They know that where they have ended up from the 8th of October, which is still holding on to the Hohenzollern Redoubt by staying in Big Willie, but the Germans are firing onto them because they know exactly where they are. They know about the structure of the trenches and the
They
shape of
built
those
them.
trenches,
The Germans built
how they're
them.
built. Yeah. So Montagu Stuart Wortley comes up with this plan. He wants to use, as sort of his first wave, he wants bombers, which is obviously they're the Mills bombs, the grenades that obviously we now know them as. He wanted to sort of almost a little bit like siege warfare, and a little bit almost not, I'm not going to say it's exactly the same, but very similar to what becomes Bight and Hold later on.
Later on, yeah.
It's a very, very primitive form of that, but he wants to attack trench by trench, consolidate,
Then move
then move
on. Okay.
on. And that's his plan, and he presents that to Haking and to Haig, who both say no.
Right.
You will attack the same way that Ninth Div did on the 25th of
So that's
September.
using a bombardment, gas cylinders, machine guns to support them. And basically walking across no man's land in a full frontal attack.
Yeah, and there's one thing that is very important as well about the, well, there's many things that are important about this. 46th Division's artillery at this point in time, well, we know standard artillery shell, it's usually it's the 18 pounder.
The
It's your
shrapnel
standard.
shells, yeah.
46th Division is still using their old antiquated 15 pounders.
Right. And they're high explosives shells, or they're
Yeah,
just shrapnel,
but there's
yeah.
nothing special about them. They can't get the velocity, they
Okay.
can't get the speed, they can't get the distance as
Right.
well.
Yeah.
So they are seriously struggling with their artillery as well. And obviously, this is a time as well where we've got the height of the munitions crisis as
Yeah, we haven't
well.
got enough, and they're in, and they're poor supply as well, the shells, aren't they? And this eventually
Yeah.
was to cause the downfall of John French, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So this brand new division who do not know the terrain, even though Montague Stuart Wortley is trying to do his best by presenting a plan he thinks works, he's then overruled
Yeah.
by Haking and Haig. On top of the fact they don't know the terrain, their artillery isn't powerful enough. The gas cylinders that they're using, I believe in the days beforehand, there were 3,000 new gas cylinders put in place.
Yeah.
But on the day concerned, only 1,000 of them were discharged
Oh, the others were
as
fighting.
well. So they were, in my mind, fighting a losing battle. But that doesn't mean that they weren't prepared and
Prepared.
they weren't, their morale was really high.
They were well trained, weren't they? Ready for a fight.
They were ready for a fight. You know, their division's general staff, Lieutenant Colonel Gaine, sends out a memo to the troops, and it's brilliant. It's after many months of work, for which you've earned high praise. It's now time to engage in active operations. It's an honor for the division to be selected.
Yeah.
One of them is all ranks must remember that the word retire is not included in the divisional vocabulary, and that every yard of ground gained must be held. You know, they are ready to go.
Yeah, definitely. So we know what the plan is. What happens next?
As I mentioned very briefly earlier, the main thing is that these soldiers don't know the ground that they're fighting on. They don't fully arrive in the trenches that they'll be attacking from until 6 o'clock on the morning of the 13th. The attack is scheduled for 2 o'clock. What happens in between that, though, is obviously they've arrived and they're starting to settle into their positions. At 12 noon, an artillery bombardment is to begin, including smoke as well. So it's not just high explosives and shrapnel, there's smoke shells being used as well.
So we've got smoke and gas, high explosives and shrapnel.
So the bombardment starts at 12, but the gas is released at 1.
Okay.
Now, it's a clear day. It's the middle of the afternoon. It's quite, for the time, it's dry as well. The weather conditions suggest it's quite dry. And the gas in simultaneously across the Hohenzollern Redoubt area does two different things. One, in places, the wind is not strong enough and collects in shells and doesn't get anywhere near the Germans. In the other case, the gas is being the releasing of the gas is stopped at 10 to 2. And by that point, at 1:50, the wind has picked up and then it's all been blown away. So they've got virtually no gas or smoke protection. Now, post the battle, there is some blame trying to be put on people somewhere. And one of the artillery officers, artillery, I'm sure he's artillery, and those and engine he's an engineer officer, beg pardon. He's releasing the gas. And he says, well, we released the gas and they didn't get out of their trenches and attack under the
Right,
protection of the gas. And it's like, well, yes,
buck passing, yeah, this happens everywhere,
they
doesn't
weren't
it?
supposed to for another hour. We
Yeah.
released at 1, as you were told, and they weren't supposed to attack until 2, as they were told. So no, of course they wouldn't get up and attack. The gas
Mm.
a lot of the gas is either dissipated or is collected in shell holes, and the Germans can see them. The artillery bombardment is stopped by 2 p.m., and most, if not all, of the units are attacking between 2 and 2:05. And I mean, it goes wrong from the start. I'm going to have to try and explain this with if people are listening, and maybe you want to get up a bit of a map. The 137th Staffordshire Brigade, so those men from South Staffords, North Staffords, they are attacking from a section of Big Willie, the trench, which is, as you look at it on the map, is on the right-hand side. Then they're sort of, and explain it like they're swinging from like 10 o'clock on a clock face to 11 is their attack. They've got like the same starting point, but they're swinging up.
Towards the readout itself.
No, they're skipping the redout. So they're attacking like the eastern side of it.
Ah,
They're
right, they're going around the
going to
side of it,
cross, they're going to cross Big Willie and dump the trench, and then carry on to a trench which is called Slag Alley and Fox Alley. So they're sort of like skirting the east of it. 138th Brigade, which is the Lincolns and Leicesters, are going to clear. So they're the ones attacking the front end of the redoubt. And they're going to push on through to the Fosse 8 Corons, which are those houses that we mentioned. What that's doing, though, if you look at a map, the way that the attack is swung through then is that because the 137th Brigade are doing dump trench and slag alley, they are not quite hitting the dump of Fosse number 8. And the attack of 138th Brigade going from the front is also missing the dump. But the intention is that they will then pincer and take
And then
it,
take it from the rear, perhaps.
outflank it basically, come at it from the rear. That's the plan. I mean, but this immediately, it goes wrong within 5 minutes. When we talk about the casualty numbers later, most of the casualties of 46th Division happen in the first 10 minutes.
But if they're
They are.
doing that, if they're going to go around the side of it, then surely within the redoubt itself, heavily defended, and they're able to enfilade then, aren't they, the Germans?
Yeah, and they are, and the dump is used as well as a machine gun position for the there's one particular group, for I think it's the 1st/5th South Staffords. There are machine gunners, German machine gunners, on the dump and on the redoubt, taking pot shots at periscopes that they're using. They destroy three periscopes in 20 minutes.
Blimey. They can see
So
you.
they know exactly where these people are. They're sitting ducks, for want of a better word. But on leaving the positions, the 137th Brigade, so the Staffords, are essentially, so there's the machine guns that are from the dump, from the Corons as well. So the final objective, because as we said, Hohenzollern's like a triangle that juts out into no man's land. But the base of the triangle is Fosse Trench and Dump Trench, and then behind that you've got the Corons and Fosse 8, and then behind that the village. That triangle shape with the Corons at every stage has got machine gunners sat on each stage, and they, because it's so flat, they any bit of high ground, in which case it's the dump, they just can they've got complete open access to the soldiers advancing across no man's land, which is 138th, the Lincolns and Leicesters, and 137th, who are in German positions already, trying to then get further into those German positions.
Blimey.
There was a private Harrison that went over the top at 2:05 p.m. And as they went over the top, he shouted, "Potters forever!" He said, "A whistle blasted, and over the bridge of death we climbed and shouted. I got clear of the barbed wire and commenced to advance, rifle and bayonet fixed in one hand and a spade in the other, under a terrific machine gun fire, bullets whizzing past me in their thousands." There was another man called Lance Corporal Maurice Ewers, and he says, "As soon as we got up, the Germans turned Maxims on us. What number I do not know, although the prisoners we captured told us there were 36 of the guns. Also told us that they'd been waiting 2 days fully prepared for the attack." He goes on, he says, "The Maxims, the machine guns, made an absolute curtain of fire, and how anybody got across, I do not know. As we had a long way to go before reaching our objective, we just went at the quick. Not the double, going forward a short distance, and then falling prone, then forward again. We lost our captain, one of the best officers we could wish for, quite early. We were all lying down when Captain Jenkinson got up to give an order. It was a brave thing to do, but he was hit and fell, and I believe he was hit a second time. That Captain Jenkinson was indeed killed that day. He's one of those that has no known grave and is remembered like so many others on the Lewes Memorial. He goes on, he says a stretcher bearer lost his life going out to try to rescue him, and two more were wounded in the same attempt. He was a fine officer, and any one of us would have done likewise. Indeed, five went out to him, and two returned unhurt. So many heroic things were done that I think it's a mistake to select a few men for the Distinguished Conduct Medal or the Victoria Cross, when others who, perhaps, showed even greater gallantry, who cannot be rewarded. I saw Lance Corporal Carlisle go out to certain death. He absolutely gave his life away in trying to get to a wounded man. Several men I saw go down like that. They were targets for the enemy the instant they got up to try and help their wounded comrades. And Lance Corporal Carlisle is also remembered on the Lewes Memorial. But then Ury suffered his own personal loss because he says, my own brother was killed before my eyes. He'd gone 200 yards and was getting near the fire trench parapet when a bullet put an end to his life. He fell back into the trench and was wedged in the bottom. Mercifully, it was almost instantaneous death. I do not know if he instinctively realised that anything was going to happen to him, but he'd left all his belongings in his valet's and had made out a supplementary will. He even mentions the gas that we briefly discussed with Beth just now. He says, as you'd have seen from Sir John French's report, we used gas before the attack. The wind was just favourable as the gas was released, but I think it changed slightly and caused the gas to lift over the heads of the Germans. We advanced under cover of a cloud of smoke.
It didn't succeed, basically, then, did it, the attack?
No, it didn't succeed. I mean, there's a statistic. I've seen it in the war diaries and in various papers after that seems to suggest that the two companies of the 1st, 5th South Staffords that were in the first line, so they're the first line, and then you've got the other two companies who are behind them and so on. There is a statistic that seems to suggest that every single officer and men of the first two companies was hit in some way.
Gracious me.
Which, when I look at my numbers and that project that I was mentioning earlier, I have got men in the 1st, 5th Battalion of the South Stafford who die on the 13th of October.
Yeah.
And I think, based off what research I've done, I think they were in those first two companies. So that first wave is just completely destroyed, whether they're killed, wounded, or whatever, they're all impacted in some way.
They're unable to fight, aren't they? Whatever happened to them.
Absolutely. Yeah. The ones that then do, so then the second wave do eventually get to the first wave, remnants of it, and find no officers and very, very few men. They're being led by, I think there's one example that I read of a first-hand account that said they were being led by a corporal.
You know, that was the highest rank that was left.
Yeah, that was available to lead, was in one circuit, one tiny section was a corporal.
And he wouldn't know what the plan was, would he?
He wouldn't have. I mean, he would know how to look to lead his section, but he certainly wouldn't know what the platoon's command plan is, or the company's plan is, or the battalion's plan is. No. You know, he will know his little bit.
And imagine the state. This is what I ask people to think about at this stage. Imagine what condition that battlefield must have been in, with the dead and the dying and the blood and the guts everywhere.
Yeah.
And also, I've read when the Northamptons turned up in this area 2 days after the initial attack on the 25th of September, they thought when they saw the barbed wire that the Germans were hanging their washing on it. And it wasn't. It was the kilts of the Scots that had attacked. So all that's still there, isn't it, from the previous few weeks?
Yeah, and can you imagine, even if you are in high morale and thinking this is a good chance for us to attack, can you imagine turning up in those positions where, if you're in the Staffords, where you're starting from is an old German trench and they already know you're there anyway and already are firing on you. You've then got this redoubt of concrete bunkers, and you can still see on a good day, if you go clambering through the redoubt, you can still see the bunkers, you know, concrete. You know, they're concrete, that it does not shift. That
no,
concrete.
It's still there. Yeah.
It's still there. Can you imagine? I try and sort of think about this sometimes, particularly I've got on one of my lists, on one of my men who dies on the 13th of October. He's 17 years old. Now, I know the rules about joining as a territorial, the age rules were slightly different, but then after the war, it is confirmed that he was 17 years old. Can you imagine being 17 years old and you have... I've looked him up prior to the war. Obviously, he'd been at school, but then he was a grocer's assistant. Imagine turning up somewhere like that and someone ran out at 17 years old.
Yeah, he's gone from, peeling, organizing carrots and potatoes, to standing there with his Lee Enfield rifle,
To kill
17
people.
years old, hasn't experienced life at all, and he who knows what was going through his mind.
And
He can't remember.
his objective is to kill people.
Yeah, that's right. Which again isn't natural, is it? It's not a natural.
So before we go any further, let's have a look at one or two other personal accounts of what happened on that day from the men that were there. There was a private Barlow, and he climbed from his trench and he said, "Up we scrambled, bullets whistling past our ears like hailstones. Off we started. The lad on my left dropped all in a heap without a murmur. About five more paces, the lad on my right dropped. Then they dropped all around me in twos and threes. I wondered when my turn would come and what it would feel like when it did come. I had not long to wait. I'd gone about 50 yards when bang, crack, got it in the leg. Just throwing my arms up in the air, bang, copped it again and right upper arm. Down I go." Private H. Holden, he was serving in a bombing party, and he said, "At 5 minutes past two, we all mounted the parapet, most of us feeling mad, some wild with thirst for German blood. Then I witnessed the most awful sight I ever saw in my life. Hundreds fell before we reached the German lines. I cannot describe what I saw, as I was too excited. Later, we got reinforced, as almost all of our officers had been killed or wounded. I got back into our own trench, thanking God." Private Joseph Barlow again. He said, "Then I lay flat, face downwards, wondering what would happen next. A few yards away lay seven or eight pals, some dead, some gone delirious. I felt more sorry for them than I did myself. I could not help crying and praying for the Lord to help them. You should have seen me digging a hole with my chin in the soft ground. I couldn't get low enough. The bullets were flying within an inch at times." Sergeant Sidney Norton, after the attack, wrote home to his wife. He said, "I crept about 200 yards on my stomach into a safe place where the stretcher bearers could get me, expecting every minute was my last. As I was being carried away, they were pinging away at us. But oh, when I was in a safe place, I prayed and thanked the Lord above. I could see him on my right and you and the children on my left."
Whilst that's happening, the Lincolns and Leicesters, who are on the left, the ones who are attacking headfirst onto the Homagnadon Redoubt, they are to some extent sheltered by those machine guns that are firing onto the Staffords. The redoubt just about shades them from the dumps, so they don't get that second line of machine guns. So they do actually get into the redoubt with relatively, say relatively, fewer losses.
What do they do then? Because they're not supported on the flanks, are they, presumably?
Well, no, they're not. Well, some Staffords are trying to make their way forward. But they carry on, the Lincolns and Leicesters. So they get in through the front end of the redoubt and head up to Dump Trench. So that's the Dump Trench and Foss Trench, which is the bottom. Like, so as we said, Hohenzollern is a triangle, but there's like two triangles. There's the smaller triangle, which is Foss Trench and Dump Trench, which makes the base. And then the bigger triangle, which is further back, which is Corons, Foss Alley, the dump.
But we're only
And
talking about a few hundred yards, if that, aren't we? Less
oh,
than
yeah,
that.
this isn't even getting into the village.
No.
This is tiny. Like, and as well, if you stand at, particularly if you go to like Quarry Cemetery and you can see the redoubt and you can see where the village is, and you go, hang on, but that's
That's
they're
it.
only going from there to there.
And yet there's hundreds, thousands of casualties, not just from that day, but the previous days, and also what's to come in the following year and beyond.
Absolutely. This isn't an isolated incident. We'd already done the attack on the 25th. We'd had the continued fighting by with the Germans trying to push back, the German counterattack on the 8th of October. This small area has been fought over three, four, five, six times in the space of 2.5 weeks,
Weeks, and this
basically.
is a battle within a battle, isn't it? The Hohenzollern Redoubt. It's
It
a whole
absolutely
book has
is.
been dedicated to it, more than one book. It's part of the Battle of Loos, but it's certainly captured within that, isn't it? These individual stories. So, what happened in the end? What was the
So
outcome?
The outcome is essentially, so particularly like for the Lincolns and Leicesters, they do get into that sort of small, the base of the small triangle, but then they're fired on from the left-hand side from a place which I think has got a brilliant name. It's called Mad Point. That's a brilliant name. But so there's fire coming from there as well. So the dumps in front of them, Mad Point from the left, they are brought to a halt at the base of the triangle. Like in any situation, there are isolated parties who do get forward, but they're never seen from
That doesn't
again.
end well, does it? No.
They're never seen again. And they try and sort of filter their way back to the heart of the redoubt. So that's that initial point and that base of that triangle and hold that. That's the plan. But what happens here then is because they're isolated in the trenches and most of their supplies are the other side of no man's lands, I mean, they had been given 3 days worth of rations, 220 rounds of ammunition, and three empty sandbags, because obviously they're planned to fortify the
Hold it.
position the other way. But 220 rounds
Not much.
is not a substantial amount,
They're
and
individual bullets, yeah?
individual rounds, 220 of them, which is not a huge amount,
No.
really. So within an hour, the attack has come to a standstill. You could probably even say less than that, probably even half an hour. They've just absolutely gone for it. Particularly the Lincolns and Leicesters, they've got into the redoubt, they've got to Fosse Trench and Dump Trench, and then gone, oh, hang on, right, stop, calm, like, what's going on? And so the fighting essentially stops there. Well, the fighting continues, but the positions don't move forward. We do now have as well the fact that we're running out of bombs, of the Mills grenades. So those bombers that Stuart Wortley had wanted to go on ahead and prepare the way, you go through a trench, and if there's a dugout, you throw a bomb down there, using the bombs to clear the trenches. We are now running out of them as well. And the German ones at the time were of a better quality as well. So they weren't having quite the impact that was
Yeah, this is
necessary.
the early days, isn't it, of hand grenades from the
It is.
British?
It is early days. And I won't say, that, the classic, oh, they sent all these people to die. No, it's not that case. It's just that we're fighting a war that we've not fought really before.
And we're looking at this, we're looking at the tactics, the resources, the soldiers, the experience of the generals. We're looking at it in hindsight again, aren't we? It's much easier in hindsight. We weren't there. We didn't have to make those decisions. We weren't under pressure from the French, who were, this was a diversionary attack from there.
Absolutely, absolutely.
All those
So,
things we don't have to worry about now.
yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the numbers are, they don't, eventually they end up having to retreat slightly, tactically withdraw, evacuate from the eastern edge of the Hohenzollern Redoubt, which is where the Staffords had been. And they do have to build like a very quick new trench line that later becomes the Cord, which sort of sits just behind it. But
They're
they're
just digging in with shovels.
digging in with shovels basically, and they're essentially in the same places that they started at 2 o'clock in the afternoon the next day on the 14th. Now, there are elements that continue to fight and to hold on. And we see that when the Germans launch a counter-offensive on the 14th, which is pushed back by some of the Lincolns and Leicesters. No, not Lincolns and Leicesters. Sherwood Foresters, beg pardon. They do, because even though they'd been in reserve, 139th Brigade, the Notts and Derbies, they ended up being pulled forward because the numbers, the casualty numbers
They
were so
need to.
high. They had to bring them forward. And we do see that. But whilst all this is going on, obviously, because we know that the Sherwood Foresters get brought forward, we do get the Hohenzollern Redoubt Victoria Cross as well. Well, one of them, which is Geoffrey Vickers, who is a captain in the 7th Battalion, Sherwood Foresters.
Shall we talk about him then? What's his story?
So his story, I mean, he's got quite an interesting, he's from was from Nottingham, so he was a local man as well. So he's one of these local men. He'd been to Merton College and studied classics until the war broke out, but he then joined the army, joined the 7th Battalion of the Sherwood Foresters, and was temporary captain by 1915. So he joined as a second lieutenant and was promoted to temporary captain by 1915.
Yes.
Later on in the war, eventually he does get promoted to major and then is given as a 2IC job for the 1st Battalion of the Lincolnshire Regiment
Okay.
in 1918. But what he gets his Victoria Cross for happens on the 14th of October.
Okay, so the
No.
day after the main battle, yeah?
It's the day after the main offensive, but they're still clinging on to
Yep.
what they've got. And his citation reads, "For most conspicuous bravery on the 14th of October 1915 in the Hohenzollern Redoubt, when nearly all his men had been killed or wounded, and with only two men available to hand him bombs, Captain Vickers held a barrier for some hours against heavy German bomb attacks from front and flank. Regardless of the fact that his own retreat would be cut off, he ordered a second barrier to be built behind him in order to ensure the safety of the trench. Finally, he was severely wounded, but not before his magnificent courage and determination had enabled the second barrier to be completed. A critical situation was thus saved." I mean, he basically sac was sacrificing himself for the safety of the trench. He said, "Build a barrier behind me." I mean, I can just imagine the two who were passing him the bombs. And he said, "This isn't working. Build something behind me and I'll keep throwing the bombs." I bet they're, "You mad, sir?" Like, that's, what madness, absolute madness. But
He wasn't an experienced soldier then, was
no.
he?
2 years earlier in 1913, he'd been studying classics at Oxford.
Really? Right.
These are not. These are not, and this is the point with even the territorials, the new army units. These are men who, if there had been no war, would never have been soldiers.
No, their lives would have been very different, wouldn't
Their
they?
lives
Different
would have been very
paths.
different. So to then expect them to behave like soldiers
Which they
is,
did. They did because they
which
didn't
they
want to let
did.
anyone down.
But it's certainly for these kind of people, in my mind, it is. I know it's, I say, judging it by maybe a 21st century standard, but it's, in my mind, it's not fair. This division as well, once the dust has settled and they finally get relieved on the 15th of October, the division has lost 180 officers and 3,500 men.
Blimey. So it's 3,700 odd total, isn't it? Now
Most of those,
1,800.
so over 3,700 men, and most of those were in the first 10 minutes.
Of course. And presumably then not a lot of those that died have a grave, I wouldn't have
No,
thought.
the majority of them don't. As I said,
Or no grave.
I've got four men on my list, my spreadsheet of the 411, four who died on that day, all in the 1st 5th Battalion South Staffords, and none of them have a grave.
Really,
Most of them don't. They're
or that we
quite,
know of, they may have a grave, but we don't know where that is,
yeah,
whether that's
absolutely. I
an
mean, there's
unknown one.
probably a significant number still under the redoubt, I would say.
The memorial is at Dud Corner, at the Lewes Memorial there, which is on the main road, not far away from where we're talking about. So, with the fighting coming to a bloody end, we now start to talk about how they evacuated the wounded from the battlefield and the trenches. Sergeant Caleb Norton, he said, "I walked along the trench. I witnessed a terrible sight of men killed and wounded and no stretcher bearers to be found. Men were in awful pain. I dressed a lot of wounds and then sent them out of the trench. Them that could not walk had to lie in a trench in awful pain for 12 to 18 hours or more." He even talks about trying to save Captain Jenkinson, the man that we mentioned earlier. He said, "By this time it was getting dark, and I thought it would be a good opportunity to get in some of the wounded we could. First, we got to Captain Jenkinson, and Talbot helped. He lay in the open for several hours, for it would have been certain death to have gone out to him. After a struggle, we got him in. It was a case of being cruel to be kind. As he lay on the fire step, he asked for a doctor. We could not do anything, for there was no ambulance man to be found. We made him as comfortable as we could. I could see he'd been hit again, for he had an awful wound in his stomach. I watched over him. I could see he could not last long. He lasted about an hour. Then we put him in a small, disused trench close by, and we covered him over." And it's likely that Jenkinson is still there, because, as we said earlier, that grave was never found, and he's on the Lewes Memorial. Sergeant Norton, together with what remained of his battalion, the 1st 6 North Staffords, reached Vermelles behind the British lines later that day. And then they were transported on London omnibuses to a place called Sailly-le-Bosse, well behind the lines.
and he recalled that they took us to a place the other side of a mill. We halted and had breakfast in a farmyard. Here we were visited by the General and the Prince of Wales. He said he was proud of us. We had done all that was expected of us. The official history of the war put it a different way. It said the fighting on the 13th and 14th of October had not improved the general situation in any way and had brought nothing but useless slaughter of infantry.
But it's so important, this attack, in many ways. You know, it's the first time that 46th Division attack as a unit.
Mm.
The first time they truly experience First World War casualty rates.
Mm.
And I personally, this is not, you know, official anywhere, it's not in an official history, I personally think this is the start of the downfall of Montagu Stuart Wortley.
Right. And what happened division. What happened to him then?
So Montagu Stuart Wortley and the 46th Division are made the scapegoats of the 1st of July 1916.
Yes. Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
I could do a whole other podcast.
We're going to have to do that. We're going to have to do
on
that.
On the 1st of July 1916. Yeah. I get very, very passionate about
excellent.
This.
That's what we want.
the blame is laid at their feet. Yeah. They have the dubious honour of having the division with the least amount of casualties. Mm. They're being called as having a lack of offensive spirit, that
yes,
they weren't
yes.
going to continue the attack. But yeah. everything that happens to them happens to other divisions across the battlefield.
Mm.
I personally think it's a personal vendetta. Mm. Haking and Haig do not like Montagu Stuart Wortley. They don't like the fact that he tried to present his own plan and was very vocal about the fact he did not like the plan that his division were being forced to do at Hohenzollern Redoubt.
And he's got that relationship with the king they won't like.
And he's got that relationship with the king. Just yeah. as, and this might be a bit conspiracy theory, just as maybe Haig is maybe seeing that...
Opportunity
is on
yeah,
the
yeah.
horizon.
Yeah.
And he just, you know, he needs the king and people like that on his side.
Yeah.
But Montagu Stuart Wortley is not his friend. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's just things that tie in that make me think that Stuart Wortley was on the radar of Haking and Haig, and they were looking for it, and Snow as well, late in 1916. Oh, and he's...
But this is Dan Snow's granddad, isn't it?
It is, yeah. But yeah. I think they were looking for an opportunity, and the 1st of July presented them with an opportunity.
And
they
did
had
he lose his job then after July 16?
And a court of inquiry ordered on the 4th of July, and he'd already been shipped off to Ireland before the court of inquiry.
We're definitely going to do that one again then. We're definitely going to do that one again. But just to finish with then, if people go to the readout now, which a lot of people don't, they miss it out, you know, they go to the other places. But if they do... Are there some memorials? Is there a memorial to the 46th North Midland Division? North Midland?
Right, so around the back of... There's two. So if you go to around the back of the Hohenzollern Redoubt,
yeah.
there is a plinth that talks about to the memory of the men of the 46th Division. It's quite a nice memorial, actually, in the fact that the angle that it's cut at, the top, because it's cut on a slant,
yes.
it's cut at 46 degrees.
Yes,
which I think
is quite right.
Nice.
Yeah.
So there's that one,
yeah.
which is behind the redoubt, which if you look at the trench lines, it's like sort of the area of where some of them may have been getting to,
yes.
particularly the Staffords. It's in the area.
They may still be there. Some of those lads may still be there.
Probably still be there, absolutely.
Yeah.
If you want, then the other way, so
yeah.
behind where the unit came from,
yes.
through the village of Vermel,
yes.
there's one on the outskirts of Vermel as
yes.
well. There's a cross to them that's quite nice as well.
Right.
But on the redoubt itself, I mean, you've got Quarry Cemetery, but the whole field, it's just completely open.
Mm.
Isn't it? Like, there's nothing there to say, here was. It's two plinths, one either side of the battlefields behind their starting point and finishing point.
And there's an amazing photo, which we'll use in the... I'll put this on my website, of the actual battlefield. Taken from quite a way back, isn't it? But all you can see is the trenches and smoke and shrapnel and you can't actually see any soldiers in that photo, but it does give you an idea of what it was like on that day. And it didn't end there, did it? Whatever happened to the Hohenzollern? Was it ever taken?
I believe it was attacked again multiple times over the course of 1916.
Yeah.
I mean, 16, I think, in that area is considered, I mean, and I use this word very loosely, a quiet area. That is a loose term. But there's fighting again in that area in
Undermining
1970.
each other as well in the spring of 1916. They were blowing each other up and it was close
Yeah,
quarter
absolutely.
fighting. Yeah.
Absolutely. And then there's further fighting there at 1917 with the Canadians at Eel
Canadians.
City, a little bit further south, which the 46th Division were in support of as well.
See, they keep cropping up, don't they? You're very
They
obviously very,
do
very passionate about them as well, aren't you?
indeed.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, right. That's fantastic. Thank you very much for doing that, Beth. Really appreciate it. And when's your next tour?
So I have some UK-based work at the end of the week, but my next tour abroad is next week, just
Excellent.
after my birthday. So,
All right. Well, have a good birthday. Happy birthday
thank
from all
you.
of our listeners all throughout the world. So,
when we look at the casualties that occurred on the 13th of October, we can look at the return of the first six South Staffords made by a regimental sergeant major on the 14th of October 1915. And he reported that there were four officers that were the roll call, 16 sergeants, and 230. But below that, he lists the deficit, the men that weren't there to answer the roll call, the men that were dead, wounded, or missing. 18 officers that were not there. Nine sergeants and an incredible 447 other ranks. The toll on the first fifth North Staffords was even worse. These men had come from the Potteries. They had 700 officers and men that entered the line on the 12th of October. 2 days later, only 200 marched out of the trenches when the battalion was relieved. But as this podcast is called Tales from the Battlefields, I think the final word this week should be given to one of those men that was there, a Private W. Williams serving with the 1st 5th North Staffordshires. He wrote to his parents, and this is what he said. "I dare say you will be a bit bothered when you hear that I got wounded. I got hit with a piece of shrapnel in the left thigh, not many yards from the German trench, so I did not have a chance to use my bayonet. I put my field dressing on as best I could. I could not sit up. So I lay out there until it was dark. Then I crawled back into our trench and lay there until Thursday morning. Then, with a stiff leg, I hobbled the best I could to the dressing station. All those who could did so, for there were such a lot who had to be carried. The Germans were using dum-dum bullets. I saw a clip of them myself. Some of the wounds were gashes such as were caused by no ordinary bullets. The task of clearing the battlefield of the wounded was a ghastly business. Besides the dead and wounded, the ground was littered with all sorts of relics, rifles, bayonets." But his last paragraph of the letter really brings it home to us. He said, "We spent the time in the trenches until Saturday morning when we were relieved. We marched back to billets and the roll call was taken. There are moments in that charge which I do not altogether remember, but never so long as I live shall I forget that drab Saturday morning that the roll call was taken. As the names were read out and no answers given, we realised the sacrifices we had made." Just imagine, if you can, in your mind's eye, the scene well behind the lines. They've no doubt rested and been fed and watered. And then the names of their mates that they've known for maybe a year, maybe longer if they'd known them in civilian life, that they trained with, travelled with, fought with briefly, the names of their pals, their mates, read out and greeted with silence. Name after name after name. Silence, silence, silence. What on earth must that have been like? Just another series of stories, really, horrific stories. Stories that tell us that those men went through experiences that we can only imagine or try to imagine. I, for one, certainly still have got no idea what that must have been like. I know that veterans of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the Falklands Islands listen to this. Perhaps they know, and I've got an idea for a future podcast where I'm going to gather together some veterans that were wounded in those more recent conflicts, and we'll find out what they went through. But that's for another day. All it remains for me to do is to thank you for tuning in once again to the podcast. Please remember to rate and review on wherever you download it from. And as usual, we'll remember all of those men that we talked about this week who died in and around the Hohenzollern Redoubt on the 13th of October 1915 by the playing of the Last Post.